Data out this month from the traffic information company INRIX show Los Angeles has the worst traffic in the world. Drivers in L.A. spent an average of 104 hours stuck in traffic during peak hours in 2016, and 10 of the world's 25 most traffic-clogged cities are in the United States. In Europe, some cities are trying to tackle congestion by limiting cars and making it easier for people to walk or bike. The city of Paris has banned cars from a stretch of road along the Seine River, and the mayor is planning to extend that car-free zone even more next year. Joining us from Vancouver is Charles Montgomery, who's an urbanist and the author of the book Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. Charles, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And changes like these car bans are not always greeted warmly by everyone. In Paris, the mayor is extending car-free zones despite a backlash from suburban mayors and pro-car advocates. What are the benefits of something like this, first of all?
Well, it's important to note that the changes in Paris are just the latest step in a series of changes that have been going on there for years. And cities all over the world are doing this simply because it makes sense. There just isn't enough room to accomplish what cities want to accomplish, which is what? Provide a robust economy, help people get to work, get people to shops and services, and beyond that, to provide a good, healthy lifestyle for people. So they're having to find new ways to move people around. And they've found that, geez, maybe it's not the most efficient way to apportion our streets when we're giving 80% of road space to the least efficient mode of transport. So that's the main reason this is happening. But it's also happening because people in inner cities are demanding it.
Do you have to, though, replace the mode of transportation? If you take away the car from a particular area, can that area just be for pedestrians to walk around? Or do you have to give people another option to get through that area quickly?
Yeah, that's a really good point. For these things to work, you need to give people alternative ways to move around. And so that means having a fantastic transit system so people can get there in other ways, in other high-status ways, faster than a car would get there. You need a robust network of safe, separated bike lanes, because we know 60% of people in cities want to try biking around but are too scared to do it on the unsafe infrastructure that's out there. But, you know, we're talking about mobility here. You also need to talk about land use. I mean, the best form of mobility out there is proximity. In other words, just being close enough to walk to stuff. So having mixed-use neighborhoods where people can walk to stuff. And, you know, Paris is a good example of that.
Well, I remember when they tried to do this in New York City and tried to take some of the streets around Times Square and close them off to cars, and so that they would be just for pedestrians, because there are so many pedestrians in that area, it was becoming difficult. And they did it, but it was not easy. They got a lot of pushback from people who wanted the cars to continue to be able to go as they always had.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. There's usually a great deal of opposition before these changes take place. And then after the changes take place, in a few months or a couple of years, polls show that people are largely in support of the changes. In New York City, for example, yeah, they shut down access for most vehicles in parts of Broadway and along Times Square. And guess what they found a few months later is that the north-south trips, taxis, were moving much more quickly than before to get to the south end of Manhattan, because they got rid of a tangled up sort of intersection bow tie. In Stockholm, for example, people really opposed a congestion charge for travel into the central city. A year or so after bringing it in, everybody's largely in favor. Because why? Well, it helps people who insist on driving to get there more easily with less traffic.
So you think that taking away cars from the roads or making roads inaccessible to cars does not create more traffic in other areas?
Well, I feel like I need to rephrase what you're saying. You were characterizing this as taking something away from cars. I think particularly in America, you need to be talking about freedom, and that is a freedom to move through your cities in a variety of ways. And most Americans don't enjoy that freedom. But to answer your question, what effect does it have? Well, I'm not sure if you've heard of the phrase induced demand. And this is a phrase we hear from traffic engineers who are realizing that when they create new road space in cities in order to deal with traffic congestion, it works, but only for about 3 or 4 years, and then it stops working because people change their travel behavior or move further away. So just as that has happened in L.A., with inner city freeway improvements. What we're finding in other cities around the world is when you take some of that auto mobility space away, it does not seem to push traffic into other areas if great transit is provided.
But, you know, you talk about how cities should replace some of what's lost to cars by expanding their transit systems. Obviously, that's a very expensive thing to do. It's much cheaper to just say this is going to be a car-free zone and everybody's going to just have to deal with it than to say, and now let's build a big subway system to replace it.
Well, I... Is it really much cheaper? I mean, yeah, Americans have been massively subsidizing travel by car for decades now, and massively under-subsidizing public transit and other ways of moving. My friends at a database journalism outfit called Discourse Media studied the cost to society of different ways of traveling here in Metro Vancouver when we had a transit referendum. And what they found was pretty amazing. When you travel in a car to work every day, you're costing society a significant amount. I've forgotten the specific numbers, but not just for the cost of the roads, but for the cost of healthcare and reduced productivity and shortened productive years. When people are taking transit or walking or cycling, for example, the infrastructure costs are lower and the payback to society is much higher in terms of better health, greater productivity, and lower healthcare costs.
So, do you expect to see more of these car-free zones brought to the United States, for example?
I think what we're seeing all over the world, and increasingly in the United States, is a recognition that the old way of moving isn't working. Now, you started with the example of Paris. Those changes can seem very extreme to Americans who are used to a certain kind of city, a certain way of moving. And I think the most successful cities make these changes incrementally, and then people demand more of them. That's what happened in a city like Copenhagen, where they just started with pedestrianizing a delightful street in their city heart, and then doing it a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. And people enjoyed it, and they asked for more. I think the changes we're seeing most in American cities are those changes that involve building bike infrastructure. Finally, American cities are starting to move on this. We see it in not just Portland, but Washington, Philadelphia, Minneapolis. Minneapolis, for example, a city that actually plows its bike lanes so people can cycle in the middle of winter.
By the way, Charles, your book is called Happy City. What's the happiest city in your mind that you've been to?
There's a bit of happy in every city, actually. I think if you're looking specifically at design, Copenhagen seems to take the cake now. So it's a place that's immensely walkable. And when we say walkable, I don't just mean pedestrian zones. I mean, they started with amazing sidewalks and wonderful street edges where there's lovely shops and services and reasons to lure you along further on your walk. And of course, they have great, safe bike infrastructure. So now 50% of people in Copenhagen are commuting by bike, not because they're being forced to, but because it's easy and fun.
You're in a pretty great city right now. You're joining us from Vancouver, which is, for people who haven't been there, just a beautiful city. Everywhere you look, these incredible views of the mountains and the water and the buildings right in the center of the city. It's very unique, but just a beautiful space and very walkable.
Yeah, you know, we made a big decision in the late 60s when the high modernist planners thought, hey, let's wrap the city in freeways. Let's wrap it up in a nice big bow. The longtime residents of Chinatown just said, hell no, they put a stop to it. And so we are the only major city in North America without a downtown freeway network. And we've benefited immensely from this. In fact, in the last 10 years, some people might find this shocking. In the last 10 years, you know, the city of Vancouver has had a policy of not adding any new road space while they add protected bike lanes and better pedestrian infrastructure. And guess what? We're the only city in Canada where during that time, commute times have shortened. In other words, people are getting to work faster here, even though cars are moving more slowly. So people say, why is that happening? Well, it's happening because people are moving closer to their workplace because we have wonderful mixed-use communities where you can do that. And they're also choosing other ways of moving, and we have a very robust transit system.
That's Charles Montgomery, who is an urbanist and author of the book Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. Charles, thank you.
Pleasure talking to you.